Good to see you on a great afternoon to drink coffee. We do not have the ability to prove that Christianity is true or that Jesus is God in the same way that we can prove that 2 plus 2 equals 4 or that hydrogen and oxygen combine to make water. That's not the nature of historical arguments or of faith in general. But we do have the ability to make a remarkably compelling case that what you read in this book is in fact from God, and that Christianity is true, and that Jesus is who he claimed to be. And although I find myself increasingly more persuaded by the beauty of Christ, by the wisdom of Christ, by just the brilliance of his responses and the teaching that he gave, I'm more persuaded that he is who he claimed to be, but by a number of what I guess you could call soft arguments. Occasionally, it's worth going back to some of the hard numbers and reminding ourselves of what we have. And there are two places where you can actually frame up the argument almost to give some odds that it's true. One of them deals with an argument for the existence of God. There are a number of these: the cosmological, ontological, moral. The teleological argument is the argument from design. It is the famous Watchmaker's article. Or argument. If you're walking through the woods and you find a wristwatch, when you pick it up, you don't think that this thing has just fallen together by luck. No, instead, you say there is a watchmaker, right? You don't think that the gears and the springs and all the numbers on the dial and all these things just happen by random chance, the wind and the rustling of the leaves, that these things just happen to come together. No. If there is a watch, you think that there must be a watchmaker. Is it possible, right, that these things did just come together by dumb luck? Well, I don't know. I suppose once in every trillion, 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 trillion years, you might have a couple pieces going together. But no, you're not going to bet on it. You're going to say there's a watchmaker. Similarly, is it possible that 100 monkeys on 100 typewriters could write the completed works of Shakespeare, given long enough? Well, I guess. You know, given trillions and trillions of years, you think they could come up with an act or two out of just sheer random odds? But you're not going to bet that that's what's happening. When you look at a watch, when you read the works of Shakespeare, you think there is an intelligent mind behind this. Well, the universe is more complicated than any wristwatch. It's more unbelievable than any Shakespeare play. And for years we have understood that there are a handful of things that just sort of, you know, they're so fine-tuned that you can't believe it's random. We need, in order for life on this planet to work, we need the temperature to stay somewhere between 0 and 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Right? I mean, if it goes much below zero, if it goes much above 100, we got problems. Well, we happen to live on a planet that just happens to be 93 million miles from the sun, which is 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And all of that works out so that we just happen to have the right temperatures to sustain life. And oh, by the way, the planet is just the right size so that it's large enough to retain an atmosphere, which it couldn't do if it was smaller, but it's small enough not to retain free hydrogen atoms, which would be a real problem. And oh, by the way, it happens to rotate on its axis every 24 hours. If it was going half that fast, then we would have nights that would become unbearably cold and days that would become unbearably hot. And oh, if it turned twice as fast, then we'd start to get into this situation. It looks like with the oceans, we're in a bit of a blender. Life would be unsustainable. And, oh, we've got oxygen at 21%. You know, if it was twice that and you lit a match, we're all toast. And if it was 10% that, we couldn't survive. You can just line these things up and say, wow, the odds of all these things happen are remarkably small. Well, we've known these things for years. In the last 15 years, astrophysicists and others have made additional discoveries that have taken this argument from design, the anthropic argument, to an entirely new level. There's something called the gravitational constant, and in the ratio between the gravitational constant and the electromagnetic field has to be precise to one part in 1 times 10 to the 40th power. I mean, that's a number you can't even imagine. One with 40 zeros after it. Right? That's how finely tuned that number needs to be for the universe to sustain itself. There are 37 of these new numbers that astrophysicists have come up with. One has to be precise to the magnitude of 1 times 10 to the 120th power. This is leading a number of scientists to come to faith in God. Not necessarily faith in Christ, but to come to faith in God. They said, I can no longer believe that this could happen by accident. Famously, Anthony Flew, a number of years ago, was one of the most prominent atheists debating on the college campuses for the last 30 years in the U.S. and Europe. Anthony Flew, before he passed away, just 4 or 5 years ago, Anthony Flew recanted his position and said, I am now persuaded by the argument from design there has to be an intelligent mind behind this. Now, there are still some who hold out. And if you ask a seasoned atheist, you know, how they do that, given the odds, what you hear is, well, yes, I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, there's only one chance in a trillion, 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 trillion that this could work out. But there are a trillion, 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 trillion galaxies, and we just happen to be the one that won the lottery. So it works for us. Well, it's not a very compelling argument. But it's actually the only argument that you've got if you are going to make a decision, almost a first case decision, that in spite of the evidence, you're not going to believe in a God. You don't want to believe in a God. Because believing in a God carries with it responsibilities. There's a loss of autonomy if you were made by a God who has demands on your life. So, we've got this whole teleological argument where we can create some pretty astronomical odds. There is a second place where we can actually do some math and make an argument that the case is compelling. And that is the way Jesus Christ fulfills the prophecies that were made about the Messiah in the Old Testament. Let me take a step backwards. This series is on Christ. And I have been arguing that there is nobody like him, right? That he is who he claims to be. He is God himself. And we should bend our knee and worship. We should follow. We should reorient our life to be around him. We should say that he's the one that gets to decide how we live. Because he's God and he died in our place. I've been making the argument that Jesus is unique. In the first message, we looked at one piece of this argument, and that is that Jesus is the one who has shaped the world more than anyone else who ever lived. And he shaped it for good, for the collective good. No one's done more for the collective good than Jesus Christ. In the second sermon, we looked at what Christ taught. And I said that he gave us an ethical system that is beyond all the other ethical systems that we've been given. This uneducated 30-year-old carpenter gave us the most beautiful and brilliant system of ethics. Additionally, in that message, I pointed out that Jesus taught a number of things about himself. And although this is shocking to many people because he lived simply, and he served as opposed to being a big figure who demanded adoration and adulation. But in spite of the fact that he was humble in some senses, he made the boldest claims anyone could ever make. Right? He said he was eternal. He said he was one with the Father. He said he was God. He said all authority in heaven and earth had been given to him. He said that he would return as judge over everyone. Right? You can't make bigger claims than Jesus made. And in that message and in the subsequent one, I said this really sets up, right, an all-in or all-out equation. Right? Jesus sort of forces our hand. We either acknowledge that he's God or we're left saying that he's a liar or a completely deranged individual. Jesus is Lord, liar, or lunatic. He is God or a bad man. In the third message, we looked at one of the things that Jesus did. Looking in John chapter 9 to illustrate this, we saw that Jesus demonstrated remarkable abilities over sickness, over death, over nature, over evil. And I noted that these abilities, these supernatural powers that he had, were not miracles per se. The New Testament word is they were signs. And they were signs that pointed not back at themselves. They pointed to Jesus. They were making the case that he is God. There are other arguments that could be presented. We could look at the fact that the disciples worshiped him, right? They didn't say he's a great person, he's a wonderful teacher, we should be more like him. They worshiped him as God. We could look at the resurrection of Christ, which in so many ways, along with the crucifixion, is the hinge point of everything. Everything in the book before the crucifixion and resurrection are pointing forward to it. Everything after the crucifixion and resurrection are pointing back to it. It is the hinge point of history. If Christianity is true, we could look at the fact that Christ said he was going to conquer death, and he did. There are other arguments that we could make that Jesus is God. What I want to set before you right now are the arguments, is the case that can be made out of the fact that Jesus fulfills the prophecies, the descriptions. He matches the identity that is developed in the Old Testament about the Messiah. So I'll develop this argument in 4 points. Number one. God is on record as arguing that one of the ways you can tell that he's God is his ability to predict the future. One of the things that God does to persuade people that he is God, okay, all-powerful, all-knowing, the creator, is he tells people what is going to happen in the future. He famously challenges the idols to make predictions about the future. Because, of course, they can't, right? So Isaiah 41, for instance, there's a passage where he says, bring in your idols to tell us what's going to happen. Tell us what the former things were so that we may consider them and know their final outcome, or declare to us the final things to come. Tell us what the future holds. Throughout the Old Testament, God is just advertising the fact he can tell the future. He can make these predictions. We see with Abraham and Sarah, he wins their confidence in part when it's starting to wane by saying, Sarah, I know you're 90 years old, but a year from now, you're going to be pregnant. And when she is, right, sort of confirmation, we really are meeting with God. Moses doesn't want to accept the responsibility of being in charge of leading the Jews out of Egyptian captivity. And as God is meeting with him, he says, Moses, your brother is on his way here. Moses hasn't seen his brother in 40 years. When his brother shows up, he goes, okay, this is a little different than what I thought. There are 10 plagues that are part of the Exodus account that were given in the book of Exodus. Okay? 10 things that God has Moses go to Pharaoh and say, you need to let my people go free, and if you don't, I am going to, it's going to be dark tomorrow, I'm going to send hail, I'm going to send locust, right? There's a whole series of things that he does. These aren't done because God needs 9 failed efforts to persuade Pharaoh. They're done in part to help the Jews, the slaves at this point, who are religiously illiterate, build their confidence in God. Realize he can control the future and he can tell us what's going to happen. So when he's telling us other things that are going to happen, we have reason to trust him. So these prophecies are given in part to confirm that God is God. And they're given in part to confirm that a prophet is a true prophet of God. There were three big offices in the Old Testament: prophet, priest, and king. The kings were over civil affairs. The priests represented the people to God. The prophets represented God to the people. Most of the time, the prophets, so we're thinking Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea and Obadiah and Amos and Nahum and Habakkuk, the people that are writing books in here, most of the time, the things that they're writing about, most of the time, the things that they're saying to the people is, you need to do the right thing. You need to do what you already know you need to do. You need to follow God. You need to care for the poor, right? You need to hold up your end of the covenant that you entered into with God. Most of the time, the prophets are forthtelling. But occasionally, they are foretelling. Occasionally, they are predicting the future. And one of the ways you could tell a true prophet of God is that their predictions were 100% accurate. And they were not vague predictions, right? Not the predictions anyone could make. I'll make a prediction right now. In the next couple weeks, there'll be a lot of talk radio hosts talking about politics. It's a prediction. You heard it here, right? Well, that's not going to build any confidence in me that I can tell the future. Yesterday, there was a race, a little 5K race, and before I left, I predicted to my family that I would win my division. And I did. My division is 51-year-olds who live in my house. I win my division every time. But that there's no power in making that kind of a prediction. In order for the prophecies to have some weight to them, they had to be made far enough out in the future that you couldn't just have reasoned your way to this. And they have to be specific enough that it's a clear answer. And the prophet and their supporters can't control this. They can't make these things happen. Okay? Well, God uses prophecy throughout this book. Point number one, proves that he's God. Point number two, many of the prophecies that are recorded in this book are about the Messiah. Many of the things that God has his prophets go on record and write down are descriptions or predictions about the identification of the promised one he's going to send. Okay? So, Genesis 1 through 11 is sort of universal history. It sets the context for everything that would follow. In Genesis 1, we hear that God creates everything, everywhere, out of nothing. It's all good. He puts us in charge. We rebel. Big break. We're broken. As a result, we're estranged from God. And in fact, we fall under a curse. The bad news is so bad, what we learn is that we cannot fix our situation. We are in eternal trouble. But God, in the context of the curse, makes a promise to send someone to rescue us. The seed of woman is going to crush the head of evil. Genesis 3, 15 and following. Genesis 4 through 11 gives us a little bit more backdrop to what's going on. Basically, it just confirms that we are really broken and the trend line is bad and we're not going to be able to fix this. And then in Genesis 12, God calls Abraham and says, Abraham, if you leave your father's place and you go here, I'm going to give you land and descendants and I will bless the world through your bloodline. Right, I am going to send that promised one through your descendants. And the rest of the Old Testament, Genesis 12, all the way out, we're just reading to figure out, is God going to keep his promise? And throughout the books, the prophets occasionally, in encouraging the people, they will remind them that this promised one is coming, and they will give descriptions about what he's going to do or where he's going to be born or what it's going to be like. Okay? These prophecies all point to the identification of the Messiah. And there are a number of them. The first one actually is Genesis 3:15, where the seed of woman will crush the head of evil. This is typical of the kind of prophecies that we find in the Hebrew Scriptures. They're a bit cryptic. God doesn't say, I'm going to send my son, who, while remaining fully God, will become fully man. He's going to enter the world after a virgin conception. He's going to be crucified on the cross, but he's going to conquer death. No, he says, the seed of woman will crush the head of evil. So you can't tell from what is said how this is going to be fulfilled, but after it's fulfilled, you go, oh, the seed of woman. That's a reference to this virgin conception. I get it now. There are a number of prophecies like this. The Genesis 12 passage gives us another clue. We learn that this Messiah is going to be a descendant of Abraham. In Genesis 49, we learn that the Messiah is going to be from the tribe of Judah. Right? And then in Deuteronomy, we learn that the Messiah is going to be one who is going to be a prophet with great authority like Moses. And in Psalm 22, 1,000 years before Christ is born and hundreds of years before there's crucifixion, we read about the death of the Messiah, that he is going to suffer and that they will mock him and that his hands and feet will be pierced and they will gamble for his robe. And then in Isaiah 9, we're told that as a child, he'll be hailed as a king. And in Isaiah 53, we're told more about his death. That in the crucifixion, he will be so bloody that we will turn away from him. He'll be so ugly that we'll want nothing to do with him. And yet, he will bear our sin on his body. And it's by his stripes that we are healed. By his wounds that we will be redeemed. You could just read through. I mean, we're told by a guy named Asaph that the Messiah is going to speak in parables. We're told by Micah that the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. We're told by Zechariah that he's going to ride a donkey into Jerusalem. Right? There's all these different statements about the Messiah that are made in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, our Old Testament, that talk about what the Messiah is going to do and be. Point number three. The odds that any person could accidentally fulfill even some of these are astronomically high. The likelihood that somebody by dumb luck could fulfill these prophecies is off the charts. Okay? So just a little refresher on probabilities, right? If I have a coin and I ask you to call it heads or tails, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it right, 1 in 2. If I ask you a second time to predict heads or tails, again, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it right. Every time we ask, you have a 1 in 2 chance. If I ask you to predict it correct 2 times in a row, you have a 1 in 2 times 1 in 2 or 1 in 4 chance of getting it right. If I had a die instead of a coin and I asked you to predict what the number was going to be, it had 6 sides on this dice, then you have a 1 in 6 chance of getting it right. If I ask you to predict it correct 2 times in a row, you have a 1 in 6 times 1 in 6 or a 1 in 36 chance of getting it correct. The math on probabilities is not that complicated. What we have, and when it comes to setting up the probabilities of someone fulfilling the messianic prophecies, what we have are a bunch of story problems. Some of them are easy, right? We're told that the Messiah is going to be from the tribe of Judah. Okay, so assuming that we control in another variable that he's going to be a Jew, now we're just saying among the 12 tribes of the Jews, he's going to be in Judah. What are the odds? Well, the odds then are 1 in 12. We're also told that he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Okay, what are the odds that he would be born in Bethlehem? Well, it's a little bit more complicated. So we're going to have to sort of use the back of the envelope and figure out what we think it might be. And different ways people have done that, looking at the geography of Bethlehem compared to the geography of the whole world and saying, yeah, this is your odds. That what most people refer to is, given first century populations, what is the likelihood that someone would be born in Bethlehem as opposed to other places where there were people? Those odds are 1 in 300,000. So what are the odds that one person could fulfill both of these prophecies? 1 in 12 times 1 over 300,000, or 1 in 3.6 million. Quickly, the number becomes astronomical. There are several hundred prophecies about Christ. In a relatively famous illustration from the 1960s, a math professor at a school out in California asked his students to figure out the odds that any person could fulfill 8 of the prophecies. And the number they came up with was 1 times 10 to the 17th, or 1 with 17 zeros after it. Now, let me illustrate this. I've shared this with some of you in the past, but it's such a perfect illustration, I go back to it. My uncle, until his retirement a few years ago, was the chairman of the Department of Geology at the University of Texas and considered by many to be one of the world's leading experts on sand. He was a sedimentary geologist. He used this skill to help oil companies find oil. He did other things as well. Over his lifetime, he developed one of the world's largest sand collections. So when we were little and we would go on vacation, any beach we went to, you take a little prescription bottle and you fill up sand in the prescription bottle, you label it, and you send it to my uncle. He has gazillion vials with sand in them. He studies them because sand has almost a fingerprint to it. Sand is made up of whatever was there, worn down into tiny little particles. He says we all become sand in the end. Well, different areas have different profiles. The beaches of Normandy are 17% shrapnel. The sand in the beaches of Normandy are 17% shrapnel. You can tell where the sand came from. He's been used to testify in murder cases. The FBI eventually confiscated his sand collection because he had the greatest sand collection, and you can use this to figure things out. All that to say, he's one of the world's leading experts in sand. When he retired, he posted his number. This is mostly a joke, but sedimentary geologists all post a number. Their guess as to how many grains of sand there are in the world. Okay? So he spent, he told me, several months working on his answer. He took this very seriously. He wanted a good, educated guess. Well, he was quite miffed when the number he came up with happened to be exactly the same number that his colleague turned in, which he had spent maybe a half hour trying to figure out. The number they both put forward was 1 times 10 to the 17th, which means this. The odds that one person could accidentally fulfill 8 of the prophecies that were made about Christ are the same odds that one person could look at a pile of all the sand on the planet, every desert, every beach, bottom of the ocean, right, and pull out the right grain of sand the first time. That's a nonsensical number, right? That's certitude at a level you don't get on anything, If you're a business person and someone could tell you the odds of succeeding are that certain, right? You invest every penny you have, every penny you can borrow. It's an incredible confirmation. And think about this. This is just one of the ways that Christ's identity is confirmed for us. This isn't just like I happen to fulfill some of these things, or you happen to fulfill them. The person who fulfills all of the messianic prophecies is the same one who has shaped the world more than anyone else for the good. It's the same one who taught with it a power and authority that no one else has. It's the same one who gave us the greatest ethical system we've ever been given. It's the same one who demonstrated a power over sickness and death and evil and nature, calmed the storm, walked on water, turned water into wine, rose a little girl from the dead, brought Lazarus back from the death. It's the same one who claimed to be God. Right? I mean, it is a compelling case that Jesus is who he claims to be. So the question I would submit to you is, are you all in? Right? What are you all in? It's not like you're being asked to put your intelligence on hold. It's that you're being asked not to keep your intelligence on hold. There is a compelling case that Jesus is who he claims to be. Now, for the record, later on, you'll think of this, if you haven't already. Well, if the case is that compelling, then why doesn't everybody believe? Why doesn't everybody see it? Right? I mean, and hey, if the case is that compelling, then why don't all the Jews see it? Well, first of all, let me remind you, faith is not a math problem. Right? We don't come to faith just this way. And secondly, let me say, many Jews do have put their faith in Christ. Right? The early church was full of people who were Jews, and they were seeing Christ as the fulfillment of prophecy. That's what Paul says in Acts chapter 26 when he's testifying in front of Agrippa and Festus. He says, look, I am here saying nothing beyond what the prophets of Moses said would happen, that the Christ would suffer and as the first to rise from the dead would proclaim light to his own people and then to the Gentiles. For a long time, this argument used to get made. It's not made so much anymore, and it's not made as effectively anymore because people don't read the Bible like they used to, and so they just don't have these things jumping out at them. If you keep reading through the book, at some point, you're starting to see these connections for yourself. So my experience in talking today with Jewish people about Christ as the fulfillment of these prophecies is that they're not familiar with the prophecies, right, at all. And it's worth noting that some of the prophecies, some of the most powerful ones, such as Isaiah 53, are not read today by the Jews. They're out of the liturgical calendar because they've been very problematic. They've reinterpreted some of these passages. And that really is the one small little window you've got. If you want to unravel this argument, I mean, basically you do it in one of three ways. You either say that the predictions that were fulfilled were actually made after they were fulfilled. Right? The way that you could get this kind of matchup, the only way you could get it is if they were actually written after they had been fulfilled. Secondly, you could say that that the person that Jesus controlled and went after fulfilling all these prophecies, right? That it wasn't random. He deliberately set out to fulfill them. Or the third thing you say is that the interpretation of the prophecies is wrong. Well, the first two arguments don't work at all. Remember, these are in the Old Testament. Christ was born 400 years after the Old Testament was written. It's already in circulation. We've got old copies. So this isn't. There's no way that you can go back and put this stuff into the text. 400 years have gone by. Secondly, Jesus could control a couple of these things, like he could decide to ride the donkey into Jerusalem in the fulfillment of the prophecy in Zechariah, but most of them he couldn't control, nor could his followers. You can't control when you're born, where you're born, what tribe you're from. You can't control these things. So the thing that you can control is the interpretation. And I would just simply say this. Look, there are several hundred of these prophecies. Maybe we're wrong on 10%. Hey, maybe we're wrong on 50%. I've just given you the odds on 8 as 1 times 10 to the 17th, right? And I don't think we're wrong on the others. The argument is compelling. So go all in. You don't get certitude like this. Jesus is God. The claims he made are true. He is unbelievable. He is beautiful. He is wise. He is eternal. He dies in our place in a gracious act of love on our behalf. You don't get offers like you get from Jesus anywhere else. Go all in. Next week, we're going to look at the crucifixion of Christ. As I said, this, along with the resurrection, are the hinge points of this book. Let me pray for us.